I think we found our theme song.
I think we did. You're listening to the dulcet tones of Roberta Flack singing the Golden Globe-nominated original theme to the film Making Love. Welcome to BGM, Bad Gay Movies, Bitchy Gay Men, episode
4!
Hey! I am your co-host, Bill Antonio, and with me is my co-host...
Daniel Krolik, hey!
We unfortunately have to report that Michael Soulard is not able to join us tonight. He is waiting in line for tickets to the Bette Midler play.
Who isn't?
Yeah, he's been there for 2 months, he's lost 3 teeth and part of his ear, but he is a determined man. But we are still here to discuss this film, but first I wanted to get to some feedback from previous episodes. We actually had a listener write in, who's actually my best friend, and she listened to episode 1 about American Pie, and Daniel had asked on episode 1 why American Pie.
Over and over and over.
It was chosen, and her theory...
The movie was the next best thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And her theory was that they were trying to use an old song and be, like, creatively progressive about it, as in normal as American Pie, but then they're the new kind of family and they're the new normal as American Pie, even though this is inverted by the fact that they're not that good at being a progressive family.
Okay, so, thanks, best friend.
Another friend of mine listened to episode 3 and responded to Mikey's question of why a bacon place would be called Rashers, and it's because, and I knew this and I forgot, a slice of bacon is called a rasher of bacon. That's a term.
So just to clarify, Rashers has nothing to do with Bad Gay Movies.
Right.
It
was Mikey's recommendation in the last episode.
But it was only his recommendation because I told him about it and he had nothing else to recommend. Mm-hmm. I hope he's having a better week in New York in line.
We also want to thank Jason Gorber, film critic Jason Gorber, for writing to us on Twitter. He said, "Fascinating work, boys. Here's to works we want to be good for completely metatextual reasons, yet fail so miserably as films."
Thanks, Jason Gorber.
Thank you, Jason Gorber. He can reach that at filmfest_CA on the Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So, welcome to BGM episode 4, where those who can't do... wine. Daniel, I know I didn't ask you this already, but do you want to give us a plot summary of our film, Making Love?
Do you have one, Bill?
No, I don't have one. You're just going to have to go from memory.
Oh, goodness. And I just saw it. I just finished watching it like 45 minutes ago. So it's vintage 1982.
Yeah.
And Carl? What's his name?
Oh, I can't remember his name.
Michael Ancine, yeah. We're not prepared. anyway, Michael Ancine is a 30-year-old handsome doctor living in San Francisco?
Somewhere in California.
Sure. With Kate Jackson, who's a very smart television executive. And they share a mutual love of, this should be the tip-off, they share a mutual love and Affair
Gilbert
to Remember, Elizabeth
Sullivan.
Taylor movies, and Gilbert and Sullivan. But Gilbert and Sullivan is such a straight nerdy
isn't
thing
it?
To get attached to. It's isn't not it? Like they fell in love to MAME.
Because I wondered about that, because I wondered if her, because she mentions it in one of her opening monologues about Gilbert and Sullivan. I thought that maybe...
I don't know. I mean, the only
and
Gilbert and Sullivan...
It's Harry Hamlin who watches Elizabeth Taylor movies, by the way.
This is true. But anyway, so Michael Ancine, and I don't even know their names. I think her name was Claire?
Maybe,
sure, why not? So Michael Ancine and Kay Jackson have been together since college. They were each other's first university loves, and they've been married for 8 years. And they're obsessed with the poet... What's the poet's name? Rupert. Rupert who?
I don't know. You know, it's a good thing we showed up prepared. Mikey knew all of this.
It's a good thing we showed up.
We have to text Mikey in New York.
So they share... Anyway, so they're married. They just moved into this gorgeous Spanish villa that they can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having some sort of marital strife in some scenes, because it's pretty random as to when they're happy and, you know, when they're not.
Don't like striped toothpaste!
Yeah. Oh, we'll get there. And Michael Ancine, who's adorable in 1981.
Absolutely.
And Canadian.
Yes.
Yeah. goes passive-aggressively cruising to gay bars. So sometimes he goes and he doesn't get out of his car and he lets strangers in and then he's like, no, I'm not ready to go there.
Might be hustlers? We're not...
Well, we don't know.
In some of the reviews, he's referred to as a hustler, but but then I don't know that he was on the professional or if he just that's just how he
So his first trip to a gay bar, he meets Harry Hamlin, whose character, this I know, is named Bart something.
Isn't it the second trip to the gay bar?
The second, yeah.
But he'd already met him in his doctor's office.
Yes, this is true. I just watched it. I'm so emotionally overwhelmed by this, by the numbing of this story.
A random patient comes in.
Oh my god, I'm shitting the bed on this.
And then they start an affair, and it throws his marriage into crisis.
Yeah.
And there's also Wendy Hiller. So, a little bit of background information.
Who has a totally unimportant, completely peripheral
role.
But she has, like, a totally standard North American accent, but she just happens to roll her R's like a British
American. Oh, yes, totally. So, as I mentioned before, the film was nominated for one Golden Globe for Best Original Song for that lovely theme. It's directed by Arthur Hiller, who is also Canadian, born in 1923.
I didn't know he was Canadian.
Glad to say he's still alive. He had his peak probably in, as a filmmaker anyway, probably in the early 70s. He directed Love Story in 1970.
Which also had a theme going for it.
Was Love Story good?
I've never seen
Love
Story.
It's so good.
Is it really?
Yes, and actually it was a killer win at a trivia contest at the Lightbox the other
night.
I was very proud of. It's really good. It's the kind of movie that you don't want to like that much, and then you watch it and you're like, this is so good.
Like my favorite.
Which is what?
Beaches.
Yeah, it's better
than Beaches. I don't believe
so he, you know, he spent many years in television, and then he started making features, including the original version of The Out-of-Towners. After Love Story, he directed The Hospital with George Segal. He did Man of La Mancha. He did The Man in the Glass Booth.
Man of La Mancha was apparently like a... I've never seen it, but it's like
a catastrophe. Not as big a catastrophe
do they
as Lost
sing?
Horizon.
Do they actually sing in Man of La Mancha?
It's like
they do?
It's Sophia Loren singing. There's The Man in the Glass Booth. He directed Silver Streak, which is a very big hit comedy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. By the time we get to Making Love, he's still on top of things. Like, he's a big director. He's still famous for Love Story. After that, he did Outrageous Fortune, starring Bette Midler and Shelley Long.
Oh, God bless.
One of my favorite
Bette Midler movies. I love Outrageous Fortune.
And then, the last time he worked was about 10 years ago, I think, in a movie called National Lampoon's Pucked, starring Jon Bon Jovi. So it's fair to say that he sort of fell out of favor.
Hey, he's still working.
The cast of the film is rather admirable. As you mentioned, we have Michael Ancine, who had already been in Slapshot.
Yeah.
We had Kate Jackson, who had already been an Angel. And we had Harry Hamlin, who had already been in Clash of the Titans and had a son with Ursula Andress, which
is
the coolest thing a person
could ever do. And the other thing,
fun
facts from IMDb, Harry Hamlin turned down a Fulbright scholarship to become a movie star.
Did he really?
Yeah.
The film also has Wendy Hiller, the great actress of who is... probably most famous for her association with George Bernard Shaw, having appeared in many of his productions, who won an Academy Award for Separate Tables. Also in the cast, if you noticed, Michael Ancine's mother at the dinner table is played by Nancy Olsen.
Oh, Betty Schaefer. Yeah, I couldn't figure out. I read her in the credits, and
yes,
I couldn't figure out who she played.
She was nominated for an Oscar in Sunset Boulevard and was married to Alan J. Lerner, the writer of My Fair Lady.
I didn't know, because Alan J. Lerner had like 17 wives.
Right. Yeah. She was one of
I didn't know she was one
she
of
was
them.
She was his wife at the time that he did My Fair Lady, because she's always the one interviewed when they do documentaries.
She looked good in Making Love, and that was like 30-odd years after Sunset Boulevard. She looks great.
Fun facts about the movie. Goldie Hawn turned down the role because she was of Claire. See, you're right, it's Claire.
Yeah, okay.
Fearing that too much of the dramatic subject matter would have to be altered to fit her comic talents and fan base. We could so have used her comic talents in this.
I would have liked to been there for that meeting when she's like, sorry, my star shines much too bright for your movie. I'm gonna have to pass.
Less shocking is that the role was offered to scads of leading men in Hollywood, all of whom turned it down because until, I don't know, 10 minutes ago, it was sort of career suicide.
They're both kind of well cast, though. Yeah. Like, Michael Ancine and Harry Hamlin are both kind of well cast in this.
Yeah.
I didn't have too much. Anyway.
Among those who turned it down included Harrison Ford, Michael Douglas, Richard Gere, Tom Berenger, Peter Strauss.
Tom Berenger was super sexy.
He was super hot. William Hurt, who actually went on to play in Kiss of the Spider Woman and win an Oscar for that.
But a different kind of gay, like a limp-wristing, house coat wearing.
Yeah, a different kind of gay. Because when you need someone to be a Brazilian window dresser, you pick the whitest guy in the world who always looks like he's in a coma. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if these are even verified. They might be apocryphal in terms of who it was that turned it down. It was also, as a result of many actresses turning it down, it ended up being the first leading role in a feature film for Kate Jackson, who really doesn't do very well with it, I must say. She's not a particular... She is so beautiful. Like, I mean, I love her look.
She is,
like,
yeah.
She's so, like, the pinnacle of that early 80s octopusy kind of woman. And she's so lovely, but she doesn't quite handle it. And I find that her scenes are the weakest in the movie with him.
There's something to her, though. And, like, Charlie's Angels is sort of one of my cultural blind spots. Mm-hmm. So, like, her, you know, I know her from the Kmart line.
Okay.
But the fact that she was an angel sort of never really registered for me. But there's a certain pluckiness to her that I found kind of endearing.
Yeah, she's game. I didn't hate watching her. I just didn't find her good. Like, I found her... She didn't have the bearings for the
role.
On the other hand,
it's a dreary.
But I mean, like, they have a lot against them. But the men have way better chemistry between them, and
they do, which is nice. Which is nice. A nice contrast from some of the earlier movies that we've been watching. That the two men actually have good chemistry together.
My favorite tidbit about this movie is that it's Camille Paglia's favorite film about gay men, because of course
explains everything.
She has no interest in seeing that dreary film again. She says of Brokeback Mountain, she had quite enough exposure to the buggy dank discomforts of camping when she was a teenage Girl Scout. Thank you very much. Arthur Hiller's intelligent 1982 film Making Love, she says, starring Harry Hamlin and Michael Ancine, remains my favorite film to date about gay men.
Where did you find that? Was that on IMDb?
I had a lot of time to Google it.
Okay.
So the film opened with a strong weekend, which according to sources means that the subject matter wasn't as big a turnoff as they had feared it might be. But then word got around that it wasn't good, and so the box office dropped off. In total, I think worldwide it made $12 million at the box office, which, to give you a sense of contrast, in 1982, number one at the box office was E.T., which made $187 million, and the second highest was Rocky III. With $63 million, which means a lot of people were going to go see E.T. like 3-4 times. It gets a 31% on Rotten Tomatoes.
In 1982, I was seeing Annie like every other week.
I was seeing it on video. I never saw it in the theater.
Oh, yeah. You missed out.
Wow. We're so gay. So it gets a 31% on Rotten Tomatoes. And some tidbits from reviews. Jeff Andrew writes, "This is a three-handkerchief movie, all right, but for the nose, it stinks."
I was going to say for those scenes where he does sit-ups and push-ups and then looks at himself in the mirror.
I tried to find contrasting...
That is a three-handkerchief movie.
Yeah, no kidding. I tried to find contrasting reviews, like positive ones on Rotten Tomatoes, and I couldn't find any from, I guess what you would call legit, like printed sources. They were all from people's personal blogs, mm-hmm. including Frederick and Marianne Brissett at Spirituality and Practice, who write... that Making Love salutes the philosophy of different strokes for different folks.
You know what? I should have read it before I got here, but I clearly didn't do any of my homework. Roger Ebert, there was a link to an Ebert review.
That was on our blog, by the way.
What?
That's on our blog.
Oh, fuck me. I'm the worst. I've had a week, guys. I'm sorry. I've had a week.
I looked up this movie in the book The Celluloid Closet by uh-huh. Vito Russo, which
yeah,
if you haven't read it is a really great book. And he writes extensively on this film, including mentioning that it's basically a gay film for straight people. And that while it is the first time in commercial film that a serious gay couple are permitted a happy ending, Hollywood thinks that's radical, he writes, and that's its mistake. If that's all the film is about, it's boring. So, let us begin our discussion of this film. Kate Jackson begins... first of all, I don't understand why this film has so many on-camera monologues.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot... It's
maybe it's prescient, because maybe it's like, you know, the fact that it was 25 years ahead of, like, The Office and Modern Family and Parks and Recreation.
But they think that they're ahead of the game by, like, making this film about gay men where they're...
And they, all kind of look like they're in heaven.
Yeah, I know. It's very early 80s, like that Lucky Star
It's very
background.
Ethereal. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's as if they honestly are terrified of people being put off by this film, or they think people are too stupid to handle it. Like, there's an opening tagline at the beginning, like, this is a film that we consider to be the most important subject matter we've ever tackled, And there's just so much preamble. And the poster had a huge long blurb about it to let people know. And it's just so strange to me how delicately they want to lower us at like goldfish in a plastic bag into this gay movie.
But again, this movie had no precedent. So it's not like they were
on that level. It had no precedent as a big studio movie with relatively well-known actors.
And even to see Harry Hamlin and Ankin kiss, which they do, and you know it's kind of hot, is sort of still a little bit shocking.
Well, I was even thinking, like, can I just say, I love that both of the men in this movie are so gorgeous. I've always had a major thing for Harry Hamlin, and I always
did.
Will.
I go back and forth on him.
Oh no,
He's a little Cro-Magnon.
He is, but I don't know. He totally works for me. Maybe because I watched Clash of the Titans a lot.
What's your Harry Hamlin vintage?
It would be Clash of the Titans. So for sure.
even before L.A. Law.
Yeah, I never watched L.A. Law. La-La, as Rosemary calls it. But I also, I love the fact that they're both good looking because that is also something that you didn't get very much of. I mean, when you think of the way gay men are portrayed in movies up until Will and Grace, most of it is horrible. And especially
it's
in
like
the 80s,
Boys in the Band when they all hate each other.
Right. And even that is like lovely compared to a lot of the things you get in 70s movies where it's just like these really, really these really hideous people who are ugly on the outside and on the inside and have no connection to any kind of like society or, anyway, and in this movie, these guys are they're lovely and appealing and really, and I really like that about the film.
And Harry Hamlin, like, his character is a very successful author. He's very well published and very recognized. And yeah, he's a jerk, he's an asshole, but he's sort of, there's no self-loathing involved in his promiscuity and in his lifestyle choices.
But there
and
is
how he leads
kind
his life.
Of. There's a conversation that they have where he gets him to just say out loud that he's gay and sort of deal with his inner homophobia, which I liked. A lot of the stuff between the two guys I liked. It's set up really badly though because Harry Hamlin goes for a checkup and it's like the most inane.
And then I thought it was going to be, and then he's like, hey, look at my neck. Is this a tumor?
Yeah,
and
I totally thought about that too.
And then I was like, is this a dying in bed AIDS movie that Bill didn't tell me about?
I thought about that, but it's not because it's 1982.
Yeah, which would have been too early.
Too early, because the first reported cases of AIDS in the news was about 1981, which means that this movie would have been made around, like, it's too early for it to be in the culture, even if it's actually physically out there. Mm-hmm. You don't really have...
And nobody was mentioning the, you know...
Right, but I mean, in terms of gay men talking about it, I don't know that you would have seen that on TV until, if you saw it on TV at all, until the, like, 85. You don't really see it hit, I guess, pop culture until Rock Hudson dies, which is a couple years later. So, so I thought that too, and it turns out he just has a ingrown hair or something.
Yeah.
But it's not really much of a checkup, and then they go for lunch to a place that has waitresses on roller skates.
Oh my goodness.
Skates,
and all his I hair think, changes. And all I could think of was Xanadu.
but then they have conversations that I really appreciated, the things they talk about. And we'll get to that later as well. But in the opening of the film, so Kate Jackson has her monologue where she talks about him loving Gilbert and Sullivan, which, I don't know, I thought that it was her way of trying to tell us that that was her first clue, but I guess you're correct. It is a straight nerdy thing.
I just think that Gilbert and Sullivan is like a historical it's on par with like historical reenactments and Star Trek
but Stewie
and
loves
sci-fi
on Facebook,
and Lord of the Rings.
On Facebook, on Family Guy, so...
I don't know. It's like, and I like Gilbert Sullivan, but all the like, here's a perfect opportunity. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's like a straight drama theater guy nerdy obsession thing.
Okay, so
it doesn't read
gay to me. We can discount that one, but
I wish they could have sat there listening to MAME.
we could totally let that one go, but because it's such a humorless film, and I couldn't tell, like, were they trying to be funny? Because there's that, but there's also, they buy a house, and he knows exactly how they're going to decorate it. He talks about that a lot. And then there's that scene, he has that patient who is losing her breast to breast cancer, which they don't really go, I guess to establish the fact that he's a doctor. And he says that losing your breast will bring you and your husband together, and I thought, this is their way of like ironically saying that her becoming more like a man by losing like a female body part.
Oh, that's a bit too like, you know, Susan Sontag. maybe that's why it's what's her face's favorite movie.
But you know what? It's weird is also is that the woman then calls him. She has a mastectomy, and then she calls him later because her husband leaves her for no longer having breasts. And she's mad at her doctor. And it's like, well, would you rather be dead? Like, I didn't really get that. I understood why the woman
and then,
was upset.
But she disappears.
Yeah, she totally disappears. But I didn't understand why he didn't ask her, like, Well, it's either that you had no breasts or that you were dead. Would you rather be dead, but your husband left you? So
it's sort of like the antithesis of the Beatrice Straight in Network scene, which is so riveting that it wins you an Oscar.
It's funny.
It's sort of like the opposite of that.
It's funny you say Network, because I also thought that her being a TV producer was also piggybacking off of Network. Mm-hmm. It was a really bad
But she's version. But she's clearly a very good and smart TV producer.
I guess
who's good at her job, even though she's constantly sexually harassed and belittled by everybody in every room of the office. It's terrible to watch.
Yeah, and she also walks into the office and says, I need time off to concentrate on my marriage, after one fight with her husband, which I find really weird. And they're like, yeah, no problem. So like, she has female problems. We don't even want to deal with that.
But her boss is like, all the men in the room when she does the pitches are vile. Which I'm sure hasn't changed.
And her boss is played by Terry Kaiser, who was on Golden Girls a few times, including the episode. He played more than one character. But he was the guy who dressed up as Santa Claus and held them up at a bank or
Of course.
And Sophia saved them because she knew that the gun was fake.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's things like we're meant to know early on. I mean, because we anticipate the subject of the storyline, Michael Ancine comes to a stop at a stoplight and these guys pull up in like their majorly 70s gay, like motorcycle.
Tom
leather,
of Finlandy.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I guess we're supposed to glean from that's why he doesn't see himself as gay, is because he's not like those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have anything to say about
that. What I do want to say is
And then
is
he
that,
says, I can't live without P&G floors after, which is really gay.
Yeah. What I do want to say is that we bypassed my legitimately favorite scene, not in an ironic way at all, when they're at the Country and Western bar, and they cover...
No, we didn't bypass that, but yes.
Oh, okay, that's favorite scene in the movie. Should we talk about it now or later?
Yes, please.
It's adorable!
It's adorable, but it's so cute. Really strange. That girl gets up and she's like... I'm going to get up on the stage and they're going to
like
me.
It's an open mic night at a Country and Western bar.
Yes.
Even though these people are totally like WASP, East Coast, Ivy League.
Absolutely.
They frequent this Country
and
Western bar.
She's like a character out of Tony and Tina's Wedding.
No, she's like, who's the awful singer in Nashville?
Glenn Wells.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gwen Wells, excuse me, who passed away very soon.
Oh.
Yeah. And then, yes, she gets up and she turns out to be completely awful and she gets booed off the stage by terribly, like really, really mean people. I've never been to like an open night... or open mic or karaoke night where if you're that bad
and it is kind of incongruous because again these are like two super WASPy educated not that you're not educated if you listen to country music guys. That's not true. They're just like fish out of water in this bar.
Yes, and they don't make it clear that they do it jokingly, like, hey, we're gonna hilariously
oh that's a hipster
western.
Thing which doesn't exist yet,
I guess. So
but what they do in the movie is it's an open mic night and there's like a prize for the best act, and this girl goes on and she totally bombs, and Michael Ancine and Kate Jackson feel so sorry for her that they get up and they do like a honky tonk version
really
of HMS Pinafore
version of Gilbert and Sullivan on the piano. First of all, she smashes the microphone. I don't know if you noticed that.
Oh, I did.
Where she's like dun dun dun, and she basically like, almost
but it's but it's so cute the... and these actors are having a terrific time doing this.
Yes, but it's terrible. It's a weird scene, and I guess it's there
but
to
it, but
establish
it also,
that they have a good time together.
Yeah,
as
and, it, and
wife.
It totally sums up their I married my college best friend without thinking things through too hard relationship.
I totally got.
But I thought that scene was adorable. I thought it was legitimately fun.
And then we have his first attempt at gay sex, which is sleazy because it's a,
oh,
it's
whose
like
isn't?
A guy. I know, because it's a guy getting into his car and he can't go through with it. Mm. And so we're supposed to understand that he is looking to make love, as the title says, and he's not into just fucking.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can't go through having sex with a man, which is immediately followed by him watching An Affair to Remember with his wife, and they both know all the lines in the movie.
But in that adorable way, because they do, but they don't. They have, like, the not really know all the lines.
Yeah.
But
watching An Affair to Remember with your college best friend is the next best thing to... having sex with a man in the front seat of your car. And then we meet Harry Hamlin, who couldn't possibly be any hotter. And I guess because it's 1982, he works out in jeans.
He works out in jeans in front of three mirrors.
Yes, in front of three mirrors. And then what does he I'm really not good on drug culture. Is it poppers that he has in his fridge that he's taking?
No, it looked like legitimate, unless if it was Quaaludes.
Okay.
Like, it looked like legitimate medication, which because then I was like, oh, is this going to be an AIDS movie? And it wasn't.
No. No, so it was definitely recreational
so,
drugs.
So maybe it was like a Quaalude, which I don't think you can get anymore.
I don't think so either.
No. And if really, anybody knows,
if any, please talk write to us Bill. At Bad Gay Movies. I really want to find myself at this gay bar where Harry Hamlin wears a flannel shirt, mm-hmm. and it's crowded. And
but like a bulky flannel shirt.
Yes, and it looks, it's. I think that's what zippers looked like 30 years ago, mm-hmm. don't. Quote me on
or
that.
What was that Hustler bar on Yonge Street? Sneakers? Do you remember Sneakers?
It's not there anymore.
Yeah.
I guess I haven't.
But it would have been like what Zippers looked like 30 years ago.
And he has a one-night
which is
stand.
Great. I like Zippers.
And he has a one-night stand, which is a wonderfully honest scene, actually, oh, where it's the cute. Young guy yeah. is just like, hey, so you call me? And he's callous without being like movie monster about it. Like,
and the guy in bed is so vulnerable because he's like, hey, let's get burgers.
But it's also not, yeah. And but it came off as real to me. It didn't come off as like stupidly.
Oh no. It came off as really sweet and weird and vulnerable, which is what happens when you have awful, weird, self-loathing gay sex, guys.
and then we're meant to see the irony of it later on because Michael Ancine kind of becomes the Harry Hamlin person in that situation when they get it on.
This is true.
There's a lot of attention paid to making Harry Hamlin the sex symbol of this movie. He showers after everything that he does all mm-hmm. the time. He's always showering. He goes on a date and he showers and then he works out. And it's justified because he's so handsome.
And he looks at himself longingly. Harry Hamlin is making love to Harry Hamlin.
But who wouldn't want to make love to Harry Hamlin? He's so lovely.
I don't know. He has like this unfrozen caveman lawyer thing happening,
Listen, Ursula Andress was much older than him when they had a kid together, and I don't blame her for looking at that and being
he
like,
has,
hello.
He has a pretty crazy track record. Nicolette Sheridan.
Oh, okay.
He made like a sleazy softcore movie with Nicolette Sheridan.
Did he really?
Which used to be on First Choice all the time.
I really admire Harry Hamlin for being in this movie and given what it would have meant for his career at the mm-hmm. time. Because for both of them, neither of them were movie stars, but they were both on their way. Like they were both.
And Harry Hamlin only got bigger.
Right. They both had made major feature films and definitely would have had management who would have advised them not to do this movie. So good for them for doing it. But also, I like the fact that Harry Hamlin did this movie without the air of. He doesn't seem to spend the movie patting himself on the back for being a gay man, like for fully playing a gay man mm-hmm. in this movie, which a lot of other actors would have done. That's how I kind of feel
and
about
it. And I like the fact that it's a movie that, you know, like we talked about Brokeback Mountain before, which I think is great, but it's a movie that the gay characters are flawed. And they're not saints, and Harry Hamlin's kind of a jerk, and he's a big asshole, but he kind of gets
it. And I like that
they
hold each other responsible for it. Because mm-hmm. at one point, he tells Michael Ancine, like, you think that it's okay for you to just be straight in real life and have me on the side.
Absolutely.
And then Michael Ancine's like, well, you think that it's cool for you to be no commitment, blah, blah, blah.
And it does. It is a movie that raises a lot of legitimate questions, which are still relevant now, about what it means to be in a gay relationship.
Yeah.
What sort of
the
rules
movie is
and
really good.
And
the one thing I wrote down is that the movie is really good when it's not trying too hard. And when it's trying too hard, it's really bad. And for the most part, it is really bad.
And it's not campy bad. It's not like a let's get together and watch this together because it's so. It's not that kind of bad. It's just a slow, ponderous.
But there are. I'm sorry, some things are campy. Like, who picks up their doctor? Like, that's weird.
Well.
Okay. All right. You know what? If you do, let me know.
I don't pick up my doctor.
But, And then Harry Hamlin also has this really, really ancient video projection system with like the
That you shine backlights. It's great.
It's amazing.
I was fascinated by it.
That like shines the worst quality image, and he's always watching Elizabeth Taylor movies.
Well, what I did love about this movie is that it is sort of an inadvertent time capsule for 1982.
Yeah, it is.
When they go on that they go on that date montage and they play the basketball game at the video arcade.
I love when they go on their date because they both wear ties. That was my favorite part of this movie.
It's so cute. And then when Kate Jackson has a breakdown and she's like, well, I'm taking my Betamax machine and I'm getting out of here.
He watches Raintree County with Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, which was actually released the same year as An Affair to Remember. I don't know if that's important. I'm just going to put that out there. But there's also a lot of scenes with like really quote-unquote cute humor, like the Little Sisters, the scene with the Little Sisters cookies, which are basically Girl Scouts, use the name.
Which I thought was just sort of like a shout-out to her, although it was made 20 years later. It just reminded me of True Beverly Hills, with Shelley Long.
Made 6 years later, but okay.
Six years later? Is that it?
Yeah, True Beverly Hills.
Oh, it's a different world.
And then it goes back to these interludes, and I hate these freaking interview sections. They're so boring and they're so unnecessary.
And each of the lead three characters has a 5-minute long monologue about their daddy issues.
Yeah. And they don't really reveal much.
Which looks like it's something that you write for your first acting class that you ever take.
Yeah, totally. With the bad Lucky Star background.
Yeah. And then she was like, Daddy never took me to Radio City. Daddy left before he took me. And anyway.
Also, Harry Hillman says...
Maybe it is a camp delight. I don't know. Maybe
Harry Hillman says in one of his monologues that he slept with him the first night he met him, but he didn't. Because they didn't sleep together when they first met.
Yeah. They just went on the longest date ever.
So they have like 3-hour monologues that don't even contribute to continuity issues. Mm-hmm. But
maybe going to the Roller Burgers restaurant is just as good as having sex with Harry Hamlin.
I also like that there's only one gay bar in this entire city because they like the coincidence of them running in together, which is not impossible to believe. But
although I did like the scene where he drove to the canyon and it was like the open air cruising area in the middle of the afternoon.
Oh yeah, that's right. Straight critics, or I should say critics in general, hated this movie, but a lot of gay critics did love it. And I think the things that we touched upon that we liked is probably the reason why, which is that it's just so refreshing to see gay men whose issues are personal relationship issues like real people have, mm-hmm. as opposed to every other movie. Whenever there's a gay theme, it always touches on like us against society or that they have a problem or a sickness, or even if they don't, mm-hmm. society sees them that way, so they end up suffering for it anyway, and they always die at the end.
And it does go through that thing, which, I mean, I'm sure it's not, you know, indigenous just gay relationships, but, you know, when you're seeing or sleeping with somebody, and then you're like, what are we? Can we define ourselves, or what are we doing? Like, it's a natural... And again, you're absolutely right. When the movie doesn't try too hard, it shines a lot of truth.
And it doesn't feel... The two men and the way they deal with each other doesn't feel like an outsider perspective, I think, mm-hmm. which is why it resonated so positively with gay audiences who were willing to forgive the fact that it's just fucking dreary.
And I know that we totally made fun of, like, Onkin going into, like, hanging out in the cars and going into the bars, but that is sort of the experience, you know, that was like what going to Woody's was like for the first time for me.
Sure, and I mean, he's a married man who's trying to like get through this experience, and that's how it makes sense.
And he doesn't even, it does ring truthful because he doesn't even know what he wants. He's there without actually knowing.
Is something a bit contrived about the way they present it. And don't forget, this is 2 years after Cruising came out, so of course gay audiences mm-hmm. are feeling very, very sensitive about how a Hollywood studio film is going to present them, because that film was such a disaster, a PR disaster, if nothing else. And then we have him going back to his wife, and
we did leave out one of my favorite scenes, which is the waspy dinner, what's her face, Betty Olsen. Okay, sorry, guys, I'm sorry.
We did pass. Well, I think we passed by Wendy Hiller though.
Okay, we did.
Her who puts on Edwardian dresses to tell
great
theater stories.
It was like, was Glynis Johns unavailable?
I know. I think it's Wendy Hiller actually didn't die until about 10 years after this, but it's one of her last films. I think she only made one or two, because she didn't make many feature films in her career anyway. She was much more a stage actress, and it's great to see this grand dame who hadn't lost it, you know, because she was in Anne of Green Gables 3 years after this, so mm-hmm. she still had some fine work in her, but she's not in any way necessary to the plot.
No.
And we have her funeral at the end,
and she doesn't really
bring the only thing useful that she provides is that she dies, and then uh-huh. that's what gets them back into the same town again when he goes to the funeral.
Yeah, and it like, I thought she was going to bring out some sort of like, you know, incipient homosexuality in the husband, but that never, like, she had nothing to do with that.
No, and she doesn't even talk about it directly when Kate sees her after mm-hmm. she finds out about everything. Kate Jackson, the way she screams at him not to tickle her is really disturbing, because she sounded like it was The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And then they go to the family dinner, and she wears a gingham tablecloth shirt. Mm-hmm. And did you notice throughout that entire dinner, she never looks up once throughout that whole dinner?
I would not. If I was at that dinner, I would be terrified.
I suppose. It's his family, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You don't make that clear.
No. As a Jew, I am simultaneously obsessed with, enamored of, and terrified of WASP culture.
It's all that white
because we just do our judging like all in front.
Yeah, you know, totally. They, yeah, no, I'm Greek. Yeah.
And I just kept waiting for like the Woody Allen split screen from Annie Hall for the loud Jewish family to come on. But man, oh man, I could watch. It was a terrifying scene.
Annie Hall is also a trivia question that I aced the other night. By the way, the question was, what got stuck behind the refrigerator And you know what it is.
Was it the lobster? Or the
lobster. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. It's been a long time since
she's wearing this adorable gingham tablecloth shirt. And then she, every time they cut to her, when he's talking, she's just spooning soup into her mouth and she never looks up once. And it's really
she made the right call. That's, again, that's exactly what I would do at that dinner because, you know, the second that I open my mouth, they're just going to, rip me to pieces.
One thing I liked is that he calls Harry Hamlin out to ask him on a date. And I like that in this film, he's very, very proactive. He's, even though he's unsure.
Without knowing what he wants. Yeah.
Right. But I like that. I like that it's not him being hit on like the E-Cupid guy, you know how his coworker was always just like trying to force him.
I and mentally blocked that movie out.
You kind of.
I had an Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind operation done, so I no longer remember E.
You're
Cupid.
Very fortunate. Yeah. But he, I expected that it would be more like Harry Hamlin constantly badgering him, but it's not. It's actually him who kind of makes it happen, mm-hmm. and then they go out on a date, and then they wear ties to their date, which is partly to denote them as
Maybe that's what I'm doing wrong. Maybe I should start wearing.
Well,
ties
they're
to
also
my dates.
They're both academic literary types, right? Because one of them is a doctor, the other one is a writer, so that's partly why they're dressed that way. But I just love that they look so like casual chic.
And what the other thing that I did kind of dig about this movie is that I like it when big studio movies let their characters be kind of smart,
sure.
and well read and well educated instead of sex crazy or which is fine, but yeah, I get a kick when, you know, there are characters who are clearly well read and who clearly reference stuff that, you know, smart people would in their lives.
And after that date is when they finally get it on in his house where mm-hmm. the fireplace is always lit and their first kiss is in long shots so that we don't fight
it took
the horses,
forever.
As Pauline Kael would say, yes.
And then he took his shirt off. You know, they take each other's shirts off.
Because it's supposed to be about, like, tenderness. And it's, for God's sake, it's just fuck. But they're both hot, so it's fine.
They are, yeah.
And now we see that Harry Hamlin, who was so mean to the other kid, has met his match because as soon as they're done, Michael Onkin quotes tea and sympathy to him when he says, when you speak about this, be kind. Which is another Deborah Carr reference as well.
You're right.
Harry Hamlin's hair gets bigger every time they cut to those interview scenes. I don't know if you noticed this.
Oh, one of them he looked like Maude.
Yeah, he totally did! And actually, there's a continuity issue because he had big, hot, scruffy hair when he first goes into the doctor's office, but then when they leave to go to the roller skate, that's when he has Maude hair.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a Marcel wave, like they weren't quite sure how to comb it.
No, he totally looks like the Arthur in the first season of Maude.
I also like that after they do it, Michael Onkin does not play the victim. He doesn't go Fatal Attraction and start being like, well, you know, it was just a one-time thing and why, you know, like he does annoy Harry Hamlin for not being more relationship friendly and sort of accuses him of liking being with a pseudo straight guy. And then when it comes time for him to tell his wife, he's quite bold about that. But first, we have to have, and this is where the movie really, really falls apart for me, is when it now focuses on his relationship with his wife, particularly when it starts to fall apart, and the movie falls apart. And they have that fight where he screams about not liking toothpaste with stripes, because we're trying to show that he's so annoyed that he's being irrational.
And you're hoping that it's going to turn into like a No More Wire Hangers kind of thing. He's just going to choke her with a toothpaste that she bought for him.
It's not a good fight scene at all. And then the next day she needs time off from work after having one fight with her husband,
although that's so fucking terrifying to be screamed at for buying the wrong toothpaste that I think I would take a month off of work too. Jackson, my sympathies.
Let's face that it's a very progressive view of women in the workplace, if that's what we think that they would do.
But I would also leave that job too, because everybody's like, okay, honey, looking good.
And I don't blame her character for being frustrated.
No.
Given that he is, you know, stepping out on her, but not saying anything to her. But her performance is really wooden, and then she breaks the plate at dinner. She breaks the dinner plate.
And then she breaks the record. Is that another scene?
And then we have Harry Hamlin and Michael Onkin back together again, and they make a giant bowl of popcorn to eat in front of the fireplace.
Well, one of Harry Hamlin's first lines in one of those confessionals, those pre-scene confessionals that open the movie, is, I don't mind being single. I can have the whole bowl of popcorn to myself.
Oh, see, there you go. Yeah. Nice to share. That bowl is bigger than his house. Mm-hmm. I don't know who makes that much popcorn.
I do.
There's a... There's a major, I guess it's a trope in the 80s of making love by a fireplace. Any Aaron Spelling TV show, this happens a lot, and I don't get it. I don't find it comfortable sitting next to a fireplace.
And I'm gonna start sweating.
Getting out, well, you're sweating anyway, yeah. And then you're just, it's uncomfortable, and you're on the floor,
and you're already naked, like you're already not at, you know,
and then you get clammy. I don't like.
Who needs it?
And also, what I like is they talk about him. He talks about something involving legitimacy of relationships, and Harry Hamlin says, "What makes you think you can't have that with another guy?"
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big sentence to say in a movie in 1982, just so you know, given that...
It's a pretty big sentence to say now.
Yeah, it totally is. And I also wondered, you were talking about this turning into an AIDS movie, and I wondered if this movie was moving towards a more progressive attitude in movies that was then ruined because AIDS was around the corner.
That's very interesting. And again,
considered a part of the movement in the 80s of these movies that dealt with gay subjects openly, and they're all terrible, like this and Personal Best with Muriel Hemingway. Or they include Victor Victoria in this list, which is not terrible. It's a wonderful film, but
it's also a period piece. Victor Victoria takes
place. Yeah, it's also not progressive. It's a
Blake Edwards sex
comedy.
Yeah,
I mean, it's wonderful, mm-hmm. but I don't consider it. And I wonder if...
Yeah. Well, it's also the window in between gay liberation and AIDS is so small.
Yeah.
So, you know, the culture that we look back on that deals with it is not... a huge...
And so if there's one reason to watch this movie, that would be wise. Yeah. Because it seems to capture that very short moment. And then she talks to
where
her
guys
dad.
Were having sex without shame and not knowing that they were getting sick.
Yeah, I guess. So then we have another old movie reference, because she talks about Roman Holiday to her dad.
She pitches the Roman Holiday TV show.
Correct.
To her dad.
Which sounds like a terrible television
show. I've heard worse.
And then that tricolor projector is the star of the film, because then he's watching Cat on a Tin Roof, 1958. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of
A movie that totally neutered its homosexuality.
Yeah. And then he finally admits to her that he's attracted to men, and she has the weirdest reaction, which is that she just goes to that shocked face, and then gets up to make a phone call.
Would you like the lamb or the veal?
She has the shocked face. And then she just decides to make a phone call, which I know is supposed to show that she's in shock, but she kind of goes Stepford Wife on him. It's really strange.
Which is weird, because up until this moment, her character was an intelligent, poised, put-together, confident woman.
Yeah.
Who...
Falls
apart very easily.
Yeah. And then says that he was her... Zach. His name is Zach.
Okay.
He was her
Sorry,
strength.
Guys. I should be paying more attention.
She says he was my strength and my protector. Although I never really got that impression from their relationship. But...
No, it was a little codependent.
I don't know if you noticed this. In the last scene the two men have together...
Maybe it's because he would sing Melody when they would do their Gilbert and Sullivan tributes. Maybe that's why.
In their last scene together, the two men... I don't know if you noticed, but I think they had a kiss that was cut out. Because they go from... They're suddenly very close together without there being a cut to explain it, and I wonder if they were like, we've had enough boy on boy action.
Could
we
be.
Just can't have any more. There was post kiss face going on the screen, so I don't know if there's that.
I didn't, but that's totally possible.
I also love that she says potato chips, which no one calls them that anymore. That's a very 80s way for a waspy white woman to say potato chips, which I really love. She wants to have a son named Rupert. She mentions Rupert a lot, which I don't even know. That's Stewie's teddy bear's name on Family Guy.
Okay.
His boyfriend is Rupert.
It's also the poet whose name I neglected to write down.
Correct. Whose apartment does she go to when she goes looking for her husband or trying to find an information? Who is
I
that guy?
I couldn't figure that out.
Was he in an
earlier scene?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
That scene was very interesting.
But it's like she just stumbled upon like Three's Company or Tales of the City.
But
because
she
was
just like she found a matchbook or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then he opens the door and like he's sitting on his hide-a-bed and he's like, hey lady, want
he's got,
some...
He's like twirly lights.
And he doesn't bat an eyelash. He's like, hey lady, want some weed?
Yeah.
Want some Quaaludes? I want Quaaludes.
Yeah, so I guess that's about it. And then we have Michael Onkin. Now he has a new boyfriend who looks like a Ken doll.
Older Ken doll. He looked older, though.
Yes.
He had like a William Hurdy
kind of
thing.
Okay. I guess because he was blonde. I don't know. It's a really heavy film, and it really shouldn't be. There's a self-righteous tone, I find, in its drama that... It definitely could have used more humor, but it feels like it didn't trust its audience enough.
But it kind of doesn't judge its gay characters, which I think is a pretty significant accomplishment for 1981.
And I did expect it to be a lot more ignorant and offensive than it actually was.
Yeah.
And that's probably because I'm used to the movies that came out later following the change in attitude that happened as a result of AIDS. But all the same, the movie is so concerned with being tasteful and controlled that as the result, there's no drama.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so concerned with being tasteful that there's no flavor.
Like that waspy family at dinner.
Basically. It's placid. And so I don't blame people for hating it because there's just, other than the points of interest culturally, I mean, at the time, those wouldn't have been as obvious.
Yeah.
Of course, because they didn't know that it was a time capsule.
Of course.
So they would have thought it was a complete...
But that is his primary value. And, you know, Kate Jackson. Kate Jackson sort of has, like, a interesting, intelligent, plucky... Even though she's not a great...
Yeah.
She's, you know, she's no Glenn Close, but she has sort of, like, a plucky...
I mean, I didn't mind that she's not a good actress. Yeah. I just thought she wasn't a good actress, and I'm not surprised that this movie doesn't lead to more.
She reminds me of Marsha Mason, who's also sort of that vintage.
No, Marsha Mason's way better than that.
Yeah, Marsha Mason's better.
Yeah, Marsha Mason was nominated for 4 Oscars.
Yeah, yeah.
But Kate Jackson really is... I just love how beautiful she is. Like, I love watching her in the film. Why does he stand apart when he goes to Wendy Hiller's funeral at the end? I didn't understand that. Was that he didn't... Because he knew...
And then right away, he's like, hey, how's it going?
Does anyone there give a shit about his drama with his wife? Like, no one knows and no one cares. Why is he standing apart? I didn't get that. And then she's gotten even prettier at the end. And then they're together. And she's got a son and a new husband. And it's the worst acting in the entire film. And what happened to Harry Hamlin? He just disappeared.
Who can say?
We find out that they have a happily ever after, but why didn't he have one?
Maybe he found another mirror to look into.
Because he narrated the whole film,
mm-hmm.
so he deserves to have an ending, if we had to listen to his monologues as well. And if you do watch this movie, all I can say is please stay for the closing song, because it is 80s classic.
Yeah. So that's Making Love.
That's Making Love. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on that we...
No, no.
Your notes have a lot of drawings on them, but...
Yeah, well, you know, I was...
Toothpaste with stripes.
Yeah, toothpaste with stripes.
So thank you very much for listening. As always, we are on Twitter, at Bad Gay Movies. And you can also find us on the web at badgaymovies.com. And I've lost my notes. And don't forget that we are on iTunes. Please subscribe to us on iTunes or on our RSS feed. And if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please rate us because that helps us a lot. And you please write to us at badgaymovies2013@gmail.com anytime. We love hearing from you guys. And if you have recommendations or just feedback about what we've already talked about, please let us know. We will be joining you again in a few weeks where we will be discussing the very BGM film 200 American. We will post a preview on the site along with our notes so that you get the opportunity to possibly watch it and review it along with us. So thank
can't
you
for wait,
joining
guys.
Us.
Can't wait.
Yes, I can't wait. Thank you very much.
Yay.